It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, crime is becoming a political issue in some midterm election races across the country. We'll talk to a historian about other times that crime has been important in politics and what those examples may teach us about today. First, the continuing labor shortage in Wisconsin has gotten a lot of attention, and part of the problem is that many workers are feeling stretched thin between work and their role as family caregivers. According to a new report, about 1 in 4 working adults in Wisconsin are adult caregivers, meaning they provide care or financial assistance to either an older family member, an adult relative with a disability, or maybe a spouse with a long-term illness. In a survey, Wisconsin family caregivers say that caregiving is having a big impact on their work and personal lives. Our next guests say there's good news. There's a lot of assistance and resources out there, and they're hoping to spread the word to caregivers and to their employers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you provide family care, maybe for a loved one with a disability, a senior in your family, you name it? Are you also working part or full-time in a job in addition to that? How are you managing it? How are you juggling it? Have you found help out there from one source or another? And how does your employer work with you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lynn Gall is Family Caregiver Support Programs Manager with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. Lynn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for inviting us.
And Harriet Redmond is Executive Director of WisconsibS and a co-chair, along with Lynn, of the Employer Engagement Work Group with the Wisconsin Family and Caregiver Support Alliance. Harriet, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Lynn, I'll start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Wisconsin Family and Caregiver Support Alliance does?
Yes. The Wisconsin Family and Caregiver Support Alliance was formed to address the needs of family, really any family member or a friend who provides ongoing care to someone at home. Our mission is really to improve resource coordination, increase access to supports, and to sustain Wisconsin families into the future.
And I gave some examples. Can you talk about what we mean by family caregiving? Now, we're not talking about, you know, a parent of kids in this category, though they may also be that, I guess.
Right. When we did this survey, we did define them as what we would consider to be outside of the traditional child rearing arena. This is really that in addition to raising children without a disability, this is caring for a family member, a friend, or it could be a young child or an adult child who has a disability that someone continues to care for years after, like another child might have left home already.
Mm-hmm. And Harriet, there's a survey now of people who are providing this kind of care here in Wisconsin. What stood out to you about how caregiving affected their work lives and how they balance that with their personal needs?
Well, the big learning from the report was almost 8 out of 10 caregivers report having their work life interrupted. And that could be interrupted by phone calls, that could be interrupted by needing to take a parent or a spouse or a child with a disability to an appointment, therapy or medical. And often those are right in the middle of the day when workers are trying to be their most productive. They also have to provide caregiving services in those prime time hours as well.
And Harriet, is it to the point for some people where they think, you know, maybe I can't sustain a job or at least a full-time job while I'm trying to do this caregiving as well?
It is. For 56% of the caregivers that were in the study reported they didn't feel that their caregiving and balancing that with work was sustainable. So they had been using tools such as rearranging their work schedule or maybe leaving or arriving at work a little earlier, a little later, even missing days of work, cutting their hours. Those are all things that they use. Those are tools that they use, but still find it can be very unsustainable and have to consider whether they continue to work or not.
We are talking about caregivers in Wisconsin, people caring for loved ones in their lives, maybe with a disability or long-term illness. and how they balance that with their work lives. One in four adult workers in Wisconsin are doing at least some of this kind of caregiving. We have Lynn Gall and Harriet Redman with us. They're part of a survey, and they're part of the Wisconsin Family and Caregiver Support Alliance. You could join in if you have a story to share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring a caller on now. Elizabeth is with us in Neenah. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about Elizabeth?
Arriving home from work early because T6 has autism and he receives care services from an agency, but like many companies, the agency is having trouble recruiting enough staff. And so today I'm going home early and I'll be taking 2 days vacation, one day tomorrow and one day on Monday, to cover that kind of challenge. And so I'm living exactly what Harriet was just describing.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. Lynn, Elizabeth points out another problem here, that workforce shortage is affecting caregiving as well, putting more stress on people like Elizabeth.
Right.
Well, I can speak to that very personally.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Because I'm in the same boat.
Okay.
I care for an adult child who has a disability, and I'm working from home today because a lack of caregivers, especially, it has been a problem, but especially now since COVID, the caregiving crisis has been even greater. So we have to balance how we manage our work and our caregiving.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for sharing that story with us. Lynn, part of what you're doing in the survey is to highlight the concerns people have. I know you're hoping to point people toward resources as well. What kind of help might be out there for Elizabeth or other people in her position?
You're right. Part of the reason we did this survey was because we think that one characteristic of the workforce shortage that we're seeing right now is, you know, we're overlooking that family caregivers need support in the workplace. And so some of the things that we would like to do as a result of what we learned in this study is to make sure, first of all, that everybody, every employer, every person who is a caregiver knows that there are community resources available through your Aging and Disability Resource Center should be the first step for anyone to find out what's available in your community. Every community has one, and there we offer a whole range of different programs that are either no cost, low cost, or available through, you know, state and federal funding or a community organization that might be able to give them support.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Joy is with us in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. I'm a woman in my early 70s. We have a daughter with Down syndrome. I was a professional, but kind of had to give up my profession to be able to stay at home and take care of our daughter and make sure that her behavior problems at school were handled well. And I've just noticed lately that my husband and I are kind of isolated. You know, we don't fit into the group of people our age who have grandchildren are playing with them, people who are going on trips, and people who are pursuing their own interests. We still have lots of responsibility to take care of a person who is dependent. So just wondering, we do have services, you know, we're hooked up with the IRIS program, so we have long-term care services for our daughter, but I'm still occupied every day in getting our daughter up and moving, you know, getting her mental health services, getting her to an activity, or getting her able to want to be in an activity somewhere else. So,
Joy, thanks for sharing your story with us. Harriet, do you have advice on the isolation, it sounds like, Joy and her husband are feeling?
Yes, it's very easily to become isolated for just the reasons that the caller was mentioning. And caregivers as a group are pretty bad at finding time for themselves. So we really have to encourage one another to do so and to to get out, but that requires caregivers, and that oftentimes is the barrier to making that happen. Another resource that could be helpful is there's an organization called Respite Care Association of Wisconsin, and they're available to help find respite care providers. And respite is that break that adults who are caring for their disabled children or a spouse or a parent, it's that break that they need in order to avoid isolation. Because once you go down that path, it's difficult, and it doesn't lead to good things. You want to be able to maintain friends and be active in the community. So finding those caregivers is a very important step. And also just finding time and not feeling guilty for taking care of yourself, whether that is a day away, just enjoying yourself, or even reminding yourself you need to make appointments with the doctor for yourself, and not just have that as a priority for your loved one with a disability or long-term illness. So it gets complex, but it really underscores the need for respite. And sometimes you just need to ask somebody to make a few phone calls for you. That sometimes, I've commented that sometimes a telephone is a pretty heavy object because you get busy with so many things and you just can't make that phone call. But maybe you can ask someone else to help you with just making a phone call. Maybe it's a neighbor or a friend or someone from church or another social circle that you can connect with.
Joy, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. Good luck to you. We're talking to Lynn Gall and Harriet Redmond from the Wisconsin Family and Caregiver Support Alliance, talking about family caregivers in the workforce. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are juggling these dual responsibilities, you're at the workplace full or part-time and providing care for a family member, what are the biggest challenges? What help have you found? What resources might you want to recommend to other people? And if you're an employer, we'd love to hear from you as well. Do you have employees who have need of some kind of flexibility to do this kind of caregiving? Are you able to provide that for them? If so, how? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Lynn Gall and Harriet Redmond from the Wisconsin Family and Caregiver Support Alliance, looking at results of a survey they did in partnership with UW Extension, looking at family caregivers, some of the challenges they face dealing with their work lives and their home lives, and how employers can offer their employees more support, maybe more flexibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your story, your experience, or your question for our guests. That's 800-642-1234. Lynn, you mentioned wanting to get resource information out to employers. Based on what you heard in the survey, are there things employers can do to support their employees who are doing this dual role? They're working, they're providing this family care.
Yes, there definitely are. And, you know, when we're doing this, we understand that not all workplaces are able to make changes for employees as easily as others, depending on the type of business. Flexible scheduling or, working remotely may not be an option, or at least not a long-term option. However, there's probably something that every employer can do, whether they're a large employer or a small employer, or even if a person is self-employed. So one of the things we want employers to think of is to think of these community organizations like Aging and Disability Resource Centers, Harriet's Organization of Wisconsin, the Respite Care Association of Wisconsin. We are your partners, and to look at us as another resource in addition to the benefits they may already be providing, and to work with us and to make your employees aware that we exist, and making your employees feel comfortable in talking about their caregiving role is really the first thing supervisors and employers can do, is because a lot of people don't even want to tell their employer that this is their home life situation or these are the struggles they're having, because they're afraid that that's going to somehow negatively impact them. So being honest about that and making people feel comfortable talking about that It really is the first step. And the survey we did was actually this UW Extension survey. It is available free to any employer who wants to use it to survey their own workforce and find out how many working caregivers do you have in your company. You may think you know, but they may not be telling you. So it's an anonymous survey that's free and available to any employer who wants to start there. And once you know how what you're, you know, what is in your company, then you can then go from there, just deciding what you can and may or may not be able to offer.
And Harriet, before we go back to our callers, the point made in the report is this isn't just something employers might do out of the goodness of their hearts. If they're having trouble hiring and retaining workers, this could be a worker retention strategy, right?
Definitely. That wasn't the main focus of our study, but we wanted to study things that we hadn't learned before. And we had learned from other studies that employers can identify savings when they have addressed the needs of their employees who are caregivers. And in a previous survey, 44% of employees in a business, 44% of them were caregivers. So it isn't one or two people. It's usually could be half of your workforce have caregiving responsibilities. And when they realize that and they can offer educational programs, or they can offer at least point them to the resources, or review their flex time or their remote working arrangements, when they can review those and tailor them for caregivers, they'll keep their caregivers, or they'll keep their employees, which is a big savings. And they can also attract other good, excellent workers who also have to balance caregiving.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in DeForest. Hi, Mary. Hi, what did you want to bring up, Mary?
So my husband and I are sole caretakers of my in-laws. They're in their 80s and with multiple health issues. So we've been providing meals and cleaning and just kind of checking up on them every day, taking them to appointments and all that. Is there any kind of state-funded program that helps family home caretakers, I guess.
Mary, thanks for that call. Lynn, is there help out there for people in Mary's situation?
There definitely is. The programs that I manage, the National Family Caregiver Support Program, and there's also a Wisconsin Alzheimer's Family Caregiver Support Program. They're both designed to do exactly what you're talking about. They can help provide people to come in and do the very things you're talking about, so you can get some respite and a break from having to caregive all the time. So they will come in and do in-home chores. They can come in and help with bathing. They provide the funds to do that. We're with the shortage of workers and out in the community, we have to have agencies that can come in and do that. But we do, it's available for anyone who's caring for someone age 60 or older. So then it sounds like the folks at your in-laws, I believe you said it was, that they are over age 60. So you would definitely qualify for that program. And anybody else out there who, if you're caring for someone who's got a diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's disease, you also would qualify.
Thanks for that call, Mary. Hope that helps. Jane joins us now in Manitowoc. Jane, hi.
Hello. I am a retired county veteran service officer, so if your caregivers are taking care of a veteran, especially if they served during wartime or if they had exposure to chemicals and stuff in service, they may qualify for a caregiver stipend for the caregiver, and then they also, the veteran may qualify and the widow may qualify for compensation or pension from the VA.
Jane, thanks a lot for that suggestion. Appreciate that. Lynn, is there a first step that people should take? And we've heard a bunch of different opportunities and resources out there. What if somebody's in a situation of caring for, say, an older family member, what should their first call be to find out what's in their area, what's available to them?
Right. Their first call should really be to their local Aging and Disability Resource Center. The ADRC has got trained staff. They do options counseling, with anyone who wants it, which is really to sit down and talk through your options. It's unbiased. It's just to let you know the different options that are available, and then to kind of help you connect to those resources once you make a decision. So that would be the very first place to go, because I know a lot of people aren't even really aware of everything that's out there until you need it and you start looking. You may find things that exist right in your own community that you had no idea were there.
Jane, thanks again for that call. Harriet, as someone who not only works on these issues, but as you mentioned, this is a part of your life too. Can you leave us with some words of encouragement to people to seek out resources that are out there and get some help if it's available?
I surely can. I would just encourage anyone to reach out and speak up. Let people know what your needs are. You probably have people who've said, hey, anytime you need help, let me know. Let them know. and it's not, don't feel guilty about that. Speak up and let people know what you need.
And Lynn, leave us with a thought for maybe, again, that employer to help that person in need.
Sure. I really encourage employers to think about the benefits to yourself as well as to your workers in supporting them. And if you've been a caregiver yourself, the employers that we have seen, some employers who've been doing some really great supportive work, and it's those employers really who have been in those shoes. They've been in caregivers themselves. And once you've been there, I think you understand how important it is and how appreciative your employees will be that you understand, and their loyalty will increase. You'll see their work improve. And I think it will, in the end, it'll pay off for you. So please consider making some, doing some work in this area.
Lynn, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Harriet, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking to Harriet Redmond, Executive Director of WisconsIBS, and Lynn Gall, Family Caregiver Support Programs Manager for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources, looking at the results of a new survey looking at family caregivers in Wisconsin and how they fit into the workplace. Coming up, a historian joins the show to talk about the history of tough-on-crime politics and what it means for this year's elections. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, part of end-of-life planning is figuring out what happens to your property when you're done. But what about all the other important non-material stuff, like your life story and the lessons you've learned? We'll hear from a rabbi and author who makes the case for passing those things on in something called an ethical will, and talk about how you can start writing your own. Now, an uptick in violent crime in cities across the U.S. has become a political issue. In primary elections Tuesday, the message from voters was mixed. Some local candidates who supported more policing had success in some races, and others, those candidates lost to people who want more police accountability. Crime is coming up in Wisconsin races, too. Here's Rebecca Clayfish, Republican candidate for governor, talking outside a Fiserv forum in Milwaukee last month after multiple shootings left 3 people dead and 21 injured in one weekend.
We need to take back control. We need to take back our streets from the violent criminals. And we need to stop catch and release policies with bad district attorneys and bad judges who simply allow the bad guys to go free and terrorize our families.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is crime a voting issue for you, more so this year than in the past? Are you worried about crime where you live? Are you going to vote on that issue in the next election at the local or federal level? Do you want to see elected officials take a tougher stance on crime or focus more on alternatives like funding social services? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Michael Flam is a history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University. He's the author of the book Law and Order, Street Crime, Civil Unrest, and the Crisis of Liberalism in the 1960s. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I love going back and looking at the 60s and maybe early 70s era for some compare and contrast. Can you set us up with how the law and order issue emerged as such a political issue then?
So the law and order issue emerges in the mid-1960s for a number of reasons, but one major cause is a sharp increase in violent crime. And liberals at first sort of dismiss the rise in violent crime. They claim it's a mirage. They claim that it's not really taking place. Later, they argue that to talk about crime is to be a racist. And then, you know, later liberals argue, rightly or wrongly, that the way to address crime is to attack the root causes, whether it's poverty or poor housing or bad education. In other words, more social programs. And conservatives respond very effectively, at least in the minds of many white middle-class voters, by arguing that no, what the United States doesn't need is more social programs. What the United States needs is more police with fewer restraints, tougher judges, longer sentences, bigger prisons. That's the law and order message that conservatives are promoting in the 1960s, and it really helps them.
Can you talk about how it helped conservatives politically and how it paid off?
It helps conservatives because it undercuts, it erodes the legitimacy of liberalism. It's a way for conservatives to attack the great society, the liberal social programs of John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Law and order also enables conservatives to attack the civil rights movement indirectly by arguing that they're not opposed to civil rights, they're just concerned about this rise in disorder, this rise in crime, the way that, you know, streets, neighborhoods, cities are suddenly feeling very unsafe for many Americans.
You've looked at the idea of security as an issue for voters over the years, and that might mean violent crime. It might be concerns about social disorder. Can you talk about security as a motivating force, or at least a potential motivating force for a number of voters?
Yeah, that's a terrific and really important point, Rob. Throughout U.S. history, at least in the 20th century, it's clear that security is usually the overriding issue for voters in an election. Now, security can take different forms. Sometimes it can be about national security, during the Cold War, for example. Other times it can be about economic security, when the United States is, you know, experiencing tough times like it is right now economically. And at still other times, security means personal security. Do I feel safe in my home, in my neighborhood? Do I feel like my family is safe? What about my friends? And so security is a critical issue. It just takes different forms at different moments.
We're talking to Michael Flam, history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University, author of the book Law and Order. We're looking at crime and law and order politicking in American elections, past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234 in this midterm election year. Do you want to hear candidates talking about crime and or punishment? And what do you want to hear them saying? Do you want to hear calls for more police or more preventive programs, more preventive social programs? What solutions do you want to see leaders, elected leaders in particular, working toward? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. All right, Michael, now here we are, 2022. We had a long, from the, you know, kind of some crime peaks in the 80s and 90s, long-term decline in many forms of crime, including violent crime. Now, in the last couple of years, we have this increase, especially in homicide, a lot of gun violence involved in that homicide. What do you look for as you watch to see how politicians use this issue or avoid the issue?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that the rise in crime that we've witnessed the last couple of years, it's taking place across the country. It's not just in cities, it's in small towns, it's in suburbs, it's in rural areas as well. So, you know, although a lot of focus has been on some high profile incidents of violent crime in, you know, cities like Milwaukee, for example, you know, we're also having plenty of shootings and tragedies and crime taking place in small towns in Texas, for example. So I do think it's important for people to keep that in mind. What I'm seeing, it's quite interesting, is that in this election cycle, liberals are really handicapped by that slogan, defund the police, which sort of grew out of the Black Lives Matter movement a couple of years ago. And you see plenty of liberals sort of trying to sort of backpedal and distance themselves from that position because it's created a big opening for conservatives to, you know, attack what they see as defund the police, or also what they see as, you know, catch and release. This has been a very popular target for conservatives, liberal DAs who have de-emphasized certain nonviolent issues and have really sort of, sought to limit the number of people who are being processed in the system and sent to prison.
Now, President Biden specifically criticized the defund the police message. I think it was a leaked audio soon after the last elections. He was worried that it had cost Democrats House seats, very likely. He made a point in funding, including COVID relief funding, of saying, yeah, the federal government doesn't provide most police funding, but bumping up police funding for communities around the country. Is the action of doing that something that's going to make a difference to voters? Is the perception of what Democrats think about crime more important?
Terrific point. Perception usually matters more than reality to voters. How issues are framed and presented tends to matter more than the underlying realities or statistics. In general, the federal government plays a small role in law enforcement in this country. Most law enforcement is local. And so the federal involvement is really at the margins. But I think that that's a really hard point to make. It's particularly hard for President Biden and for liberal Democrats, because in general, liberals argue that the federal government can and should play a role in trying to solve the major problems that we face as citizens and as voters. So it's hard for them to back away on this crime issue, even though technically the president's correct.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Northern Illinois. Scott, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Good. At the point of it, I think the Democrats have become too progressive with the whole war. Not criminalizing misdemeanors and whatnot, but I think the Republicans have become too hard in enforcing the war on drugs. And I'm all for let's legalize marijuana, but I think we still need to maintain criminal, charges, people who are dealing it. But I think part of it too is let's lower the taxes on marijuana and let's make it more affordable so it can compete with the black market, and we can keep people out of the system that way. That's just my thoughts on it.
Scott, thanks for the call. A couple things there. First of all, is there a viable sort of middle ground position for a candidate in a time like this to take on crime, Michael?
I'm not sure there's a viable middle position for a candidate or for a politician. We've seen sort of hyper-politicization in our process, and we've seen sort of for politicians, there's a lot of risk and not a lot of reward for moving to the center. You know, you want to play to your base, whether your base is progressive on the left or conservative on the right. I do think the caller makes a good point. You know, there is a middle ground here to decriminalize certain aspects of marijuana use and possession, particularly when it's nonviolent. Unfortunately, we've seen a lot of movement in that direction, and it's coincided with a sharp increase, as you pointed out, in shootings, in killings, in violent crime. And it's not necessarily cause and effect, but they're happening at the same moment. And so they're contributing to this sense in the minds of many voters that their streets and their neighborhoods have become a lot less safe.
Scott, thanks for the call. We're talking to Michael Flam, history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University, with us today to talk about how crime has shown up as a political issue in past election seasons, what it might tell us about a focus on crime in elections this year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is crime an issue that brings you out to the polls? Is it an important thing you want your candidates for any office to address, local or federal? Are you worried about crime in particular in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about crime as a voting issue in American politics. Michael Flam with Ohio Wesleyan University stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If we surveyed you, would you put crime at or near the top of your list of issues you are worried about? Why or why not? What do you want to hear Democrats talking about, Republicans talking about when it comes to issues of crime, crime prevention, incarceration, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael, it wasn't that long ago that I was talking to coalitions of conservatives and liberals who are really interested in prison reform, getting the numbers of people incarcerated down. President Trump made some cases during his term about that, made some high-profile efforts to bring some people out of prison. Is that era over now, do you think?
I think, Rob, it is over. There was a moment where it seemed like politically there was an alignment. Conservatives wanted to shrink the prison population in order to reduce public spending, reduce costs. And liberals were interested in moving away from this mass incarceration model where we filled our prisons with individuals who had committed nonviolent crimes and where the United States had more people behind bars than any other country in the world. So there was this brief moment where, you know, the interests of liberals and conservatives were in alignment. But now I fear that the politics of law and order have reemerged, and the conservatives see it as a clear winner for them. And so I don't think that they're going to move to the middle ground or make any concessions to liberals.
Do you think that the politics that surrounds this actually gets in the way of solutions, of getting people together to find actual solutions for the problem of crime?
I do think that the politics of crime and the politics of law and order do get in the way of finding a compromise, finding a middle ground, finding common sense solutions. Of course, you know, law enforcement, criminal justice is not unique in that regard. We do find that, political gridlock or deadlock prevents us from moving ahead on a host of issues.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hello.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, you know, that the whole headline, you know, crime wave, it really does bring people out. It gets the base fired up. But what are we talking about? Are we talking street crime? Are we talking internet crime, white collar crime? I'm getting out to the polls because I'm going to vote against the crime against democracy. I'm not for insurrectionists running for office in Wisconsin, so that's getting me out to the polls.
Martha, thanks a lot for the call. It's an interesting point, Michael. I think people, when they think crime, they are thinking, as Martha said, of street crime often, of violence in cities, but as you pointed out, elsewhere. Other people might have other focuses when it comes to crime.
It's a great point. You know, we publicize, we politicize certain crimes. If it bleeds, it leads in the media. And the caller is absolutely correct. We could focus on white collar crime. We could focus on internet crime. We could focus on political crimes in different forms and formats here. So it's a very good point. I will say that politically, you know, it's the sensational violent crime that attracts public attention. You know, it's the violent crime in the streets, not the crime in the suites, white collar crime that tends to get the attention from the media.
Well, it's a thanks for that call. That kind of visceral reaction, like we might agree that white collar crime is bad. If I wasn't the one fleeced by it, I might not feel that visceral reaction, though. We might not like the insurrection at the Capitol, but it doesn't have that "it could happen to me" element to it.
Well, that's right. And the costs of, white collar crime, let's say, are widely distributed and usually relatively small for individuals. Whereas the impact of violent crime, I mean, that falls really hard on individuals, on families, communities. It's much more concentrated and much more, I would say, directly, viscerally painful for those who are affected.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kathy is with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Well, hi. Yeah, it's going to be an issue for a lot of people in Wisconsin. Walker and Clayfish got rid of background checks when purchasing guns when she was lieutenant governor and Walker was governor. So we don't have that in Wisconsin anymore. And anybody under 21 should not be able to purchase an R-15. That's the last three shooters, the Texas one, the Park Falls, and the Tops grocery store. All those kids were under 21 with an IR-15. And I'd rather have them banned altogether, but at the very least, get them out of the hands of these kids under 21. And I'm really pissed about that. So, yeah.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Michael, is that maybe a response from Democrats instead of emphasizing the word crime in gun crime, emphasizing the word gun and trying to hit that as an issue?
Well, it is interesting. And in the 1960s, liberals and Democrats in particular sort of for the first time raised gun control as a possible response to violent crime. It does make a certain degree of sense, certainly certain types of weapons, mental health issues, young offenders. The problem here is that most Democratic politicians, particularly those who have to run statewide, are simply scared of the gun control issue. They sort of almost view it as the third rail of American politics. It's, you know, no reward, plenty of risk, no real upside. And so although it might make sense, I don't see a lot of Democrats, at least those who are not running from safe, you know, seats or districts, really putting gun control front and center.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Flam, history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University, about crime as a political issue. Back to your calls now. Liz is with us in Dodgeville. Liz, hi.
Yeah, hi. Say, I just want to say I live in southwest Wisconsin, and I think the whole defund police thing for Dems was kind of a fake issue. I think it was pertinent in a couple of communities, but I think the media seized upon it. I'm the chair of the Iowa County Dems. I don't know a single Dem who wants to defund the police. I think we actually need community police who march around the neighborhood, know people, and mental health teams, such as the one they have in Madison, that can de-escalate people who suffer from mental illness. We already know that if we put some money into early childhood programs, such as poverty and excellent daycares and preschools, that's where we're going to get a payback. And don't have all the people with low incomes stuck in the same neighborhood together. There should be affordable housing interspersed. So it's sort of a combination, and I hate that everyone tries to make it an either-or. It's not a black or white, and I think there's a lot of common ground, but that's not how people tend to think or vote these days, and it's a shame.
Liz, thanks for that call. Michael, what do you think?
You know, it's another terrific point by one of your callers. I also do not believe that there are very many Democratic politicians who support the idea of defund the police. Unfortunately, the slogan got out there, promoted by the media, and now it's been politicized. This is another case where the perception, unfortunately, matters more than the reality. The caller is absolutely correct. We do need more emphasis on mental health. And it's true that very, very few Democrats, particularly politicians, professional politicians, endorse the slogan of defund the police. But that's the perception that's out there.
Thanks a lot for that call, Liz. Michael, in just our last couple minutes, are there lessons you think we can learn from the politics of crime back in the 60s and 70s to, again, we've got a lot of partisanship today, but to maybe overcome some of the hot button sides of things and arrive at solutions?
Well, the lesson for liberals and Democrats is that they need to take the issue of order and security very, very seriously. Because for voters, particularly middle-class white voters, that's really, really important. And they should know that conservatives take the issue very seriously, and they're going to use it whenever they can. At the same time, I want to go back to the point, moving beyond the political issue, we really do need to try to hold politicians in both parties on both edges of the sort of political spectrum. We need to hold them accountable in terms of demanding sort of common sense middle ground measures that will really address the issues of crime and violence in our society more effectively.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Michael Flam, history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University, author of the book Law and Order, Street Crime, Civil Unrest, and the Crisis of Liberalism in the 1960s. He's with us today to talk about the role crime has played as a political issue in American elections and whether it will do so again in this year's midterms. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Email ideas at WPR.org. The U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol plans a hearing tonight. Join us for live NPR coverage starting at 7. committee says the hearing will present previously unseen material documenting January 6th, receive witness testimony, preview additional hearings, and provide the American people a summary of its findings. That's NPR coverage tonight at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. We'll follow up on that tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time. And coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if we're feeling uncertain about the economy, well, how should we manage our money? Get some personal financial advice and join the conversation with your own questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes it can be tough to keep up with all the hot new pop music and what's on top of the Billboard charts. But sometimes you can just wait a while and something old is going to show up again. Like this week when the Billboard Top 10 includes a song from 1985. As reported by NPR, the new season of the Netflix series Stranger Things features the Kate Bush song Running Up That Hill from 1985. Now back in the day, it topped out at the number 30 spot on the charts. But thanks to a burst of interest from Stranger Things fans, the song re-debuted at number 8 this week. Not just the U.S., the song hit the top 10 in 34 different countries. Has anything like this happened before? NPR points to Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. It made a comeback after a famous scene in the movie Wayne's World and hit number 2 in 1992. And Dreams by Fleetwood Mac hit number 12 2 years ago after appearing in a viral video. Running up those charts, this is Central Time.